The following programming is sponsored by Lou Scheinfeld. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
He's got it. Bow! The champion will not be denied. John McEnroe with a smashing finish. The new king of Philadelphia.
Every one of us is a walking museum of sports, from that first ball game with your parents to maybe getting that nervous, sweaty autograph to maybe even taking your own kids to their very first game. It's the feeling we all get that kind of brings us back to our own personal Philly field of dreams. And the Museum of Sports show is on the air and ready to go there with you. I'm Doug Scheimel, our show dedicated to sports memories, memorabilia, and the museum that is going to capture it all right here at the Philadelphia Sports Complex. We're live on the Talk 860 and Museum of Sports Facebook pages. So check us out. Museum of Sports show brought to you by the Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. Joining me from on a this week only appearance from his tennis bunker in Villanova, Pennsylvania. He is our guide and mentor, Comcast Spectacor legend, founding vice president of the Philadelphia Flyers and creator of the Museum of Sports and author of the recent book. And I say this every week, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. Ladies and gentlemen, Philadelphia's Greatest Showman, Mr. Lou Scheinfeld, who has a very, very special story here on today's long-threatened Why Can't Philly Host Pro Tennis Again? Lou?
Well, we used to host it. In fact, we had the world's biggest indoor men's and women's late 60s, early 70s. You gentlemen might have known Ed and Marilyn Fernberger back in the day. They were very big tennis fans in Philadelphia, and they brought in all the top players in the world, male and female. And for several years, the Spectrum hosted the world's largest indoor. And during that time, Billie Jean King came to Philadelphia and wanted to start the Freedoms professional tennis team. And one day I was out on the court. I don't play tennis, so I'm terrible at it. But I happened to be hitting back and forth with somebody, and she saw how I served, and that was ping pong. I threw it up and touched it, so hopefully it would go over the net and in that little white box. And she said to me, "Would you like to know how to serve?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, of course." She says, "Okay, you see the scoreboard up there at the top of the ceiling? I want you to throw the tennis ball up and try to hit that scoreboard. But before you do, pull your racket straight down and the ball will go over the net and into that white spot." She didn't call it the white spot. I did. And sure enough, after a couple of missed tries and all, I became a pretty good server. Of course, I couldn't return. I didn't have a backhand or a forehand, but I could serve the ball at maybe 40, 50 miles an hour. And Billie Jean King taught me how to serve at no charge.
details. Who needs anything else? So this is the long threatened Tennis Palooza show. I've been talking about it for the last 2 years. Why can't Philly host pro tennis again? And we've got an all-star lineup of tennis experts and our King of Sports Collectibles, whose family has the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection, and our proud partner in the Museum of Sports, Nick DePatche Jr., will be along toward the end of the show to talk tennis collectibles and maybe even do some spot appraisals for some of the memorabilia some of our guests may have at hand. So let's get to the introductions. He was part of the International Tennis Hall of Fame class with Andy Roddick and Kim Clijsters. He's a sports writer, author, television commentator, who has been fascinated with tennis ever since he was a kid. He was a tennis statistician for Dick Enberg and NBC and the legendary Bud Collins during the CBS tennis coverage years. And he's profiled all the greats like Pete Sampras, Chris Evert, Jimmy Connors. And with tennis Bibles that he has written, like Greatest Tennis Matches of the 20th Century and Greatest Tennis Matches of All Time, to his credit, he is considered a well-rounded tennis player by some of, I believe, his British college pals. A proud Museum of Sports show. Welcome to Mr. Steve Flink. Steve, how are you?
I'm great, Doug. I appreciate the introduction. Well-rounded. I may not quite qualify for that label, but I'm delighted to hear it.
happy to have you with us. Our next panelist, he was a ball kid for pro tennis in the late 60s and eventually learning how to teach tennis from Billie Jean King's very own tennis coach. He cut his teeth on South Jersey courts when Rod Laver was king in the late 60s. And this guest's pro tennis teaching career has taken him around the world, a writer for the tennis website at one time and a contributor to Tennis with an Accent podcast, a hell of a tennis player and caterer himself. Say hi to Skip Schwartzman. Skip, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, and very pleased and honored to be part of this discussion. Thank you.
And finally, he's a longtime member of the Philadelphia Sports Congress and PHL Sports, and they are tasked with bringing big-ticket sporting events to Philadelphia. He was captain of the Rutgers tennis team, and he's been a club champ at Germantown Cricket Club, where I've fallen on my face many a times, and club champ around the globe. He's been witness to Philly's U.S. pro tennis history at the Spectrum and Virginia Slims at the Civic Center, and a friend of Billie Jean King, and helped to bring one of the championships or one of the rounds to Drexel University. And he's a man who sneaks in a little bit of a neuropsychology professorial stuff at Drexel in his spare time. Welcome to Dr. Eric Zillmer. Did I get that right, Eric?
Yeah, thank you, Doug. I love sports. I love talking about it. And I love tennis. So I'm looking forward to chatting with you all.
Hey, I want to start off because we talked about kind of that illustrious history of tennis. And you heard a little bit in the clip there at the top with John McEnroe beating Jimmy Connors in the U.S. Pro Indoor Championship. I want to say that was what, mid-late 70s, early 80s, if I recall correctly. Steve Flink is a Hall of Fame sports writer and author. Philadelphia has a seminal role in American tennis, dating back and before Bill Tilden, who kind of grew up at his aunt's place overlooking the grass courts at Germantown Cricket Club, all the way through Billie Jean King's formation of World Team Tennis and the Freedom and some of the other things we kind of alluded to off the top. But there are so many generations who don't know that. Kind of in a nutshell, how significant is Philly in kind of grooming young players going back years, decades?
Oh, immense. I don't think you can undersell it, Doug, because you alluded to some of it. But you think about it. I mean, the women started the U.S. National Championships. The men had started in Newport in 1881. The women began in 1887 at the Philadelphia Cricket Club. And they were there from 1887 through 1920. Meantime, the men who had played in Newport and eventually settling at Forest Hills, they came to the Germantown Cricket Club to play the Nationals there. Tilden coming through there had already won at Forest Hills, and he won the first one there in 21. They were there 21-2-3. So it really dates back to those, but also the Marion Cricket Club, which had a big grass court event going back to the 1890s all the way up to 1974. That was a mainstay on the grass court circuit for the men over the summer. So there's just, and then of course we go to the U.S. Pro Indoor, which became really one of the most important events outside the slams especially in the 1970s. And the women had a lot of pro tournaments in Philly as well. It's an astonishing heritage. Probably exceeds any other city in the United States for the amount of, in terms of significance and big events that were held in that town and many or in its clubs, empire.
Yeah, many of those clubs still in existence. Marion, Philadelphia, Germantown. We may have the highest concentration of grass club courts in the country here. I could be wrong on that. Skip, I got to ask you. You were a ball kid at the pro U.S. pro indoor matches when they were held here in Philly. And I talk about how deeply ingrained tennis was, you know, decades ago. It was a big deal. It was sort of up there with the pro franchises, the Phillies, the Flyers, the Sixers, the Eagles.
Well, yes, it's very true. I mean, I grew up, as you mentioned earlier, on public parks, and I'm not so sure that would have happened as readily if I didn't live in an area like Philadelphia that has the history that it does. As Steve alluded to, you know, the history of tennis is really intertwined with Philadelphia. Mary Outerbridge, who is credited with bringing tennis to America, to North America, to the United States, was a Philadelphian. R. Norris Williams, who won the national championships in 1914 and 1916, was a Philadelphian and a survivor of the sinking of the Titanic. So there's been a lot. The Tennis Patrons Association in Philadelphia was very instrumental in developing tennis here. They were founded in the mid 1950s and supported it. And then, of course, there was the pro tournament that was at Marion for many years as a lead up to the U.S. Pro Indoor. Women's Nationals at Grass is still held at Marion. And then, of course, there was the professional tour that was at St. Joe's prior to its moving to the Spectrum, where I was a ball kid for a number of years. So there's a deep history here. And as was mentioned, I don't know, you know, exactly if the stats are that such that we have some more grass courts than any place else, but it's really darn close to it.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, we mentioned briefly ahead of the show, another fellow from the region, Vic Satius, who is just turned or is turning 100 very soon.
Yep. And, you know, I knew about him. I was fortunate, as you mentioned, to learn tennis to a great degree and learn how to teach from Mr. Frank Brennan Sr., who was Billie Jean King's first coach out of California. And Mr. Brennan made a point of teaching all of us about the history of tennis. And it was just that if you learn tennis, you know, in a club or public parks atmosphere, when you were more exposed to generations, it was easier to learn the history of tennis at the time than I think kids get it today at the academy. And so we knew about Satius. He had, as I think I mentioned, and Steve might be able to correct me on this, I think he had the greatest Davis Cup winning record in American Davis Cup history until John McEnroe surpassed him, obviously, and won majors as well. And I actually saw him warm up labor one time at the U.S. Pro Indoor in Philadelphia at the Spectrum. So yeah, we had, and there were a slew of very high quality players here in Philadelphia who never made it on the tour because that just simply wasn't what they went out to go do. But there were a lot of tough club players here for many, many years.
Absolutely. Eric, there were one brand name event after another, the U.S. Pro Indoor, the Virginia Slims, which I use one of the promotional pictures for the social media promotion. You know, the days of a cigarette company sponsoring sports are, you know, decades bygone. You know, you've got the Advanta tennis, you know, notwithstanding some of Advanta's, you know, issues on the business side and the IRS and Justice Department side. But there was a pretty, you know, stout listing of big ticket events that were here in Philly.
Yeah, no question. I would even include World Team Tennis. I remember that Sloane Stephens played on the Philadelphia Freedom, you know, and we knew she was good, but we all were excited when she won the U.S. Open. But you know what, Doug, I would even go back 100 years. You know, there is a real tennis club court in Philadelphia. It's called Court Tennis at the Racquet Club, you know, and it's a fun game, but it actually is the predecessor of modern tennis. Yeah. So Philadelphia has one of the 40 courts in the world. And if you contextualize it, look, Philadelphia is an amazing city, but it was a world-class city. The World's Fair was here in the 19th century. Things were made in Philadelphia. And of course, it's the birthplace of our country. So it's not a coincidence that a sport like tennis brought our communities together, our neighborhoods. The clubs that could play each other. It was and is an amazing social catalyst. And the history is unequaled, really. Yeah. And when you are a member at Germantown Cricket Club, you can't escape it. You walk through the clubhouse and you really walk the history. There's pictures of Bill Tilden. Yep. And you just feel that it is a very, very special place. And I feel that this history is worth gold. But having said that, you know, it's 2024, and what have you done for me lately? And so the reality is, what is it? What does that all count? Does it add up to anything?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's, I think some of it, you know, Philly was a very proud city, but then the nation's capital got moved to D.C. Other things got farmed out to New York, and Philly became this kind of, and Lou, we talk about this all the time, it kind of succumbed to a kind of a crippling inferiority complex, that it was just the also-ran city jammed in between two other major metros, and things just start to happen, you know, that affect tennis's popularity. And we're going to go to break here, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at kind of what happened. What the hell happened? But before we do, we want to make sure our viewers and listeners go to themuseumofsports.org to make a tax-deductible donation now so you can be part of Philly's Sports Shrine today. And don't forget to buy Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. Just go to themuseumofsports.org, and Lou will pen a personal greeting with a very sharp crayon. When we come back, all these great pro events in tennis in Philly, what the hell happened since then? That, with our expert panel with the Museum of Sports Show, continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. Back in a couple of minutes.
It was 1967, and Philadelphia was in a rut. The economy, riots, Vietnam. That is, until the Broad Street Bullies rallied the region's spirits and brought more than 2 million into the streets to celebrate. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's candid memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You'll love the inside stories about Frank Sinatra, Ed Snyder, Bernie Perrant, Frank Rizzo, Elvis Presley, the 76ers, Mick Jagger, Electric Factory Concerts, and Kate Smith. And you'll find out how Lou Scheinfeld helped Ed Snyder rescue the Flyers and, against all odds, got the Spectrum built. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed first edition copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. The book the Philadelphia Inquirer called a fascinating and hilarious read. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. An ode to a building that truly rocked. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatchi is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat heart disease, hypertension, palpitations, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Dr. Nicholas Depatchi, MD, FACC, author of 4 books and over 100 articles and abstracts, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Did you miss a recent Museum of Sports show? No worries. You can see or listen to any of our previous shows on the Museum of Sports website or on our Facebook page. You'll love our lineup of great guests, including Merrill Reese, the Eagles' Vi Sekahema, Bill Berge and Kevin Riley, Flyers broadcasters Jim Jackson and Steve Coates, and the Phillies' always colorful Larry Boa. The Museum of Sports is on the air and Facebook, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860 and Facebook Live.
Well, the statistics bear out what you already know. It was an outstanding effort, Fred Stolle, by the man who won the championship, Pete Sampras.
The Unisys match stat for the day, as you've seen him here, 48 winners hit by young Pete Sampras, and he did it all day, and that makes him the youngest player ever to win here at Philadelphia. So mark that name down for the future.
Well, I think a few folks marked down Pete Sampras' name, and the future certainly bore out everything he showed when he was here at the U.S. Pro Indoor. We're back on the Museum of Sports Show on Talk 860 and Facebook Live, brought to you by the Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular Center, specialists in non-invasive treatment. I'm Doug Scheimel, along with Lou Scheinfeld. Our guest panelists are all tennis all-stars, discussing why can't Philly host pro tennis again? It's not asking much. In our first segment, we talked about Philly's illustrious history of iconic pro tennis players and tournaments. But where in God's name did it all go so horribly, horribly wrong? So, Eric, I'm going to start with you. I guess we kind of left off with you because it felt so good for decades and generations. And, you've witnessed Philly, through the early days and all the venues here. I mean, what have you started to see happening to Philly's interest in tennis? And does it reflect kind of a national malaise, to borrow from Jimmy Carter?
No, I think tennis is doing amazing. I'm watching the French Open. They have a prize money of $58 million. Women's tennis is the highest income sector for a women's sport. And there's only a few sports in the world that have complete equality and payout, that one of them being tennis. So tennis is doing great. I think the city of Philadelphia is doing great. You know, we reinvented ourselves. We're an incredibly sports fanatic city. I mean, there's a reason why this show is in Philly. And we've, we're really not even lucky. We deserve to have FIFA 26 here, the World Cup in soccer. the largest sporting event in the world. So if you can, if you could bid on that and beat out Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, you're obviously doing something right, you know. Plus the city, I live in a city, I live in Old City. I'm only three blocks from the from our birthplace. It's a really wonderful, you're walking history. It's voted as the most walkable city in America. And our restaurant scene, I will challenge anybody, is second to none, okay? So you have to look at the reality. It's like when you try to get a tournament here, and there's four things that go into it.
Yeah.
And it has to be a win-win for all of it. And I'd love to hear what the other people think about it, okay? So the first thing you have to have is you have to have a tournament that you can bid on. I'll give you an example. Last weekend, we had the national championship in men's lacrosse here in Philadelphia, okay, at Lincoln Financial Field. I know it well because when I was athletic director, this is the first time we bid on it and hosted it, okay? So you need a tournament. What tournament are we looking at in tennis that we could get from Indian Wells or from somewhere and bring it to Philadelphia? That's number one. Number two, you need a venue. So in lacrosse, the Lincoln Financial Field is perfect. You need a partner. So if the Eagles aren't in, who own the stadium, if they're not in, it's a dead end, right?
Yeah.
So like things like the Olympics with a velodrome, we don't have a swimming pool really that's Olympic size. Yeah. You know, we don't have a track and field in Philadelphia. Okay, the staple of any Olympics. Okay.
Yeah, Franklin Field for the Penn Relays, but everything is sort of ad hoc or piecemeal.
That's right. Yeah, and so. You know, so you need a venue. So it opens up the discussion whether you truly need an all tennis venue. I would be of the opinion, yes. Okay. And then really what we do is on the Sports Congress, we're a collection of about 50, 60 people. We organize the bid or we create leverage and organization to it. Just imagine that there's an event and it approaches a city in terms of hosting the sporting event. And if you don't have organization, it stops there, okay? And so we're really a catalyst. We can't create the event. We're just putting a lot of things together. And if you look at WrestleMania that just occurred in Philadelphia, they wouldn't have been here without the Sports Congress of Philadelphia. And that they had an impact of $50 million economic impact of Philadelphia.
The attractiveness is there. It's inherent. You know, NFL draft.
It's totally.
We've got Major League Baseball All-Star in 2026. I mean, it really, really is here. My question is, and Steve, I guess I want to ask this of you. You know, I've always felt, and I take a lot of heat for this, that despite the Hall of Fame successful careers of Serena and Venus Williams in recent years, that, and dispute me, the popularity of tennis in the United States is driven by the success of U.S. men players. And we have not had a contender since your International Hall of Fame classmate Andy Roddick. I mean, how true or false is that?
No, that's very valid. Andy won the U.S. Open in 2003. Think about that. That's 21 years ago. And we haven't had a male Grand Slam singles champion since. The Bryan brothers carried on much longer. They were terrific. And as you mentioned, Venus and Serena. No, I think it's crucial that another superstar emerges from this country. Although we've been going through a golden era, we're wrapping up a golden era right now with Federer, Djokovic, and Nadal, and many fans in this country have been enraptured by those players too. But I agree, you need a male American player in the forefront of the game, and that could change the picture dramatically in terms of the viability of American tournaments, because this is not just a question of Philadelphia. Other American cities have lost their events too. Used to be that the players went from Forest Hills, the U.S. National Championships, even the U.S. Open, on to the Pacific Southwest in Los Angeles, and then on another big California event at the Berkeley Tennis Club. There was always there was a wealth of American events, and so many have gone by the wayside. But I think your point, Doug, is very well taken.
Yeah,
can I just jump in? Because
yeah,
I
absolutely.
Think,
good, Eric.
You know, it's like – Steve is, of course, correct. But in the WrestleMania, which is, I don't know even if this is a sport, but I met a family that came from New Zealand. Okay. It's entertainment with their children. And so when you're talking about creating an event in Philadelphia, it has to be a destination.
Yeah.
Okay. There has to be people who are willing to travel to see, you're saying an American athlete, but I'm thinking, you know, I mean, it's a global sport, tennis. You know, I'm not so sure. You know, when you ask an arena, are you interested in this event? They have to think it's a sellout. Otherwise, they're not going to proceed. So when you have the wrestling NCAA championship at Wells Fargo, they're thinking it's sold out no matter what.
You need to tout that economic ripple. Skip, I mean, what is your take on what drives domestic tennis popularity? And have we just seen kind of just an ebb of that since the Roddick days?
Well, I think it's pretty indisputable that having, you know, one of the world's top best players drives interest in tennis in the country. And by that, I mean any country. You know, where's Sweden been as a tennis power since Borg and Wielander faded from the scene? You know, are the Spanish tennis academies really that much better than the rest of the world that that's why there's so many good Spanish tennis players? Or has it been Nadal and company that have driven that top of the fold sports story in Spain for so long? Yeah. And I also think that the player, you know, whoever that is, needs to be somewhat charismatic in some way. I'm not sure Sampras, as great as he was, really would have entered the public's consciousness if without the foil of Agassi, because Pete wasn't really a media friendly interview, Steve's book notwithstanding. Exactly. And I also think the truly major sports, and I kind of call tennis the number one niche sport in the world. I think the truly major sports, football, American football, basketball, baseball, even hockey. I mean, they're so much bigger in America today than they were in the mid 80s that programming against them, either as an in-person event or TV or streaming platforms, is really tough. It's a challenge.
Yeah,
I think you guys are wrong. I don't think you need an American player. For it to be sustainable, it has to be global. Just look at Formula One racing. It's been nowhere in America.
And my son is a huge fan, and there's a huge fan base here.
And you go to, they have races now in Las Vegas, in Austin, in Miami. They have 350,000 people show up.
Yeah.
The guys who win this have like an accent on their name, okay? Right. There's no American.
Right.
So
but in fairness,
I think it's a one, yeah, go ahead.
Motorsport's the number one sport in the world. I mean, not Formula One, motorsport across all the things. And I mean, we're not talking about having an event in Philadelphia that's going to draw 350,000 people, because there isn't a tennis event that draws 350,000 people, much less a one-day event where it's a weekend really for Formula One. And we don't have the facility for it. I don't know that they're really comparable to each other. I would think in some ways that the wrestling event is probably more comparable, but they're so, as I understand it, they're so dependent on streaming television broadcast in a way that tennis just hasn't gotten that kind of strength yet in the streaming market or the television market as wrestling. That's really where the dollars are for wrestling. It's not in the number of fans that walk inside the door. I can't believe that's the real draw.
Lou, in your time at the Spectrum, were you starting to see over time a decline in ticket sales for some of those, the pro level tournaments?
As long as we had the big names, the people came. But when we didn't, towards the end, and we cut down in both the men's and women's size, the fans did not come.
And what was the final decision made? Obviously, it was made by those events that they were just done, I'm guessing.
Well, the Fernbergers weren't making enough money. and I don't know if you folks dealt with Marilyn, but she was a pistol. In fact, I had her thrown out of my office during a meeting about the tennis thing. And later in life, I became very close with her, and she was okay. And she tried to do it all over again, but it was too late. But she and Ed put on those big, big tournaments, and I give them credit.
Yeah. Go ahead, Skip.
Yeah, so can I also mention, Lou, I mean, I think also that, you know, if you think back to the tournament, there used to be originally, so when I was there in the early 70s, mid 70s, there were two courts side by side of the Spectrum.
Right.
And the players hated that. The courts were really close together, and keeping track of what was going on when you were on one court versus the other was difficult. And Marilyn, I'll call her by her first name, I never really knew her, but, you know, she was always going out convincing players to come, and I think they soured on it. And then they went down to one court. And the opportunities for players to be other places than Philadelphia in the dead of winter, and I love it here. I live in South Philadelphia. I wouldn't choose to live anyplace else. But, you know, it became a tougher and tougher sell for them as the money increased and there were other places for them to be. And, yeah, she was, as my mother says a pizzeria. So there was that too.
Yeah. I called before, I want to very quickly before we go to break. I want to throw this out there. Who wants to touch what I call the third rail of racket sports in the United States and its impact on popularity of tennis? And that is pickleball and padel. I call it the opiate of the weekend warriors now. Is that eroding the tennis base? I just saw promos for pickleball TV on YouTube TV now. I mean, to what extent has that kind of burrowed into what would have been the modern tennis fan base? Anybody?
Yeah, I'd like to tackle that one, if I may.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a serious problem. There's a lot of people in the tennis community that seem enamored of pickleball, but it's gotten to the point where a year ago, and we had Medvedev playing a final in Miami against Sinner, and at the same time, and that match was on opposite a pickleball event featuring the likes of Agassi and McEnroe. And
I saw
and
that.
You say to yourself, wait a minute, hold on a second here. Is this really what's best for the sport? Plus, they're eating up tennis courts all over the United States too. I must say, I don't include myself among those who think that pickleball is doing the sport of tennis any favors. And I'm very concerned about it.
Anybody else?
Well, you know, I helped build the squash center at Drexel. It's now, I would say it's the best squash facility in the world.
It's beautiful.
And we've been hosting the U.S. Open for 10 years now, 15 years. And even in squash, it's impacted pickleball and padel. As somebody who endorses recreation and activity, I think it's a good thing, okay? If you can't beat out pickleball, you can't. Come on, guys. I think the number one reason we don't have a tournament here is we don't have a tennis-specific stadium, and we don't have money. You have to pay these players a lot of money. And if you look at golf and the BMW Open at Aronimink, you need a lot of money in the price pocket, and you need a golf course. It's obvious in golf. Why wouldn't it be obvious in tennis?
So, all right, we got to go to break here. So with no dominant American men's or women's tennis champions to drive tennis popularity here at home, is it even worth trying to attract another pro tournament, assuming one were ever put out there for bid? Our panel is going to take that on when the Museum of Sports Show continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. Back in a moment.
Can you imagine Philadelphia without the Broad Street Bullies or its fabled Spectrum Arena? Well, it almost happened until Lou Scheinfeld and Ed Snyder, otherwise known as Flash and Cash, teamed up to rescue the Flyers and got America's showplace up and running. It was 1967, and the world was in a whole different place. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's heartfelt memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, now available. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatchi is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas Depatchi, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market? We do, and that's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Manayunk Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednarik, Bernie Perron, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
The world premiere of big league tennis comes to Philadelphia. Billie Jean King and the Philadelphia Freedoms meet Pittsburgh Monday, May 6th at the Spectrum.
We're back on the Museum of Sports Show, sponsored by the Depatchi Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. So the topic today, why can't Philadelphia host pro tennis tournaments like it used to decades ago? It was sort of the epicenter of tennis in the United States. That's today's rant and rave. And we've looked at Philly's amazing pro tennis history with our panel of experts, why the city and maybe the country are losing interest. And now, I mean, is it really even worth trying to attract pro tennis events back to the city of brotherly love? So, I mean, do we even need another pro level event, Steve?
Well, that that's open to debate. Do we need? I'd like to see it happen. I think you have a point. That's a number of very prominent events. We used to have a lot more than that. Let's not forget Cincinnati, which has been enormously successful. But I believe, looking at it from geographical standpoint, I mean, Boston was another great tennis town that has gone by the wayside. That used to host men's and women's, had the U.S. Pro Championships, which was one of the more prominent events for a long time. So I just feel like it's more a question, does Philadelphia deserve a renaissance? Does it deserve a resurrection? I believe so. And I think under the right circumstances, it could happen. I mean, Eric's alluding to, you build the event over the players. So he's made the case for, yep, it. We don't even need to have an American superstar. I believe it would be great. Prospects would be enhanced considerably by that happening. But either way, I think that Philadelphia merits a big time event once more based on its heritage.
Where does that, I mean, that's going to emanate from where? What, there's so many different governing bodies in tennis. You have the ATP for the men's tour, the WTA for the women's tour. USTA is sort of kind of this weird hybrid that kind of encourages local and, you know, regional participation. It's also an intake for young talent, but you've got international governing bodies too. I mean, who would be the one to kind of be the catalyst for that event? Skip, I don't know if you want that one.
I'm certainly happy to start. And by the way, you're talking about the multiplicity of associations and organizations in tennis. That doesn't really make Eric's job at the Sports Congress any easier in terms of dealing with tennis. My hope is that there are two competing programs right now being promoted to consolidate the tennis competitive world, the pro world. One is from the Saudis. They're promoting something along the Live Golf lines.
The Live model, yep.
Right, the Live model. And the other is a really kind of a rebuttal to that, put together mostly by Craig Tiley, along with, I think, the Big Four tournaments are all involved in that. Am I right with that, Steve?
The ITF, yeah, is it? And the USTA as well. Sure.
And the USTA as well. And what they're suggesting is that there's a top tier where basically the men and women predominantly at combined events, which statistically do way, way better than individual events, especially on the women on the WTA side, that the top players play what are now considered the 1,000 level tournaments. And right, then the lower tournaments, the 500s and the 250s and maybe the 125s, are a feeder circuit and there's a higher bar for participation in the 1,000s, which right now are, you know, huge draws. And by the way, you know, we forget that the Spectrum was a 64 draw tournament. So the tougher tier gets smaller, but it gets greater prominence and it has a higher bar for entry. Yeah. My hope is that that's the program that wins out versus the Saudis for tennis in general. And that secondarily, that the opportunity to bring a 250 or even a 125 to Philadelphia is greater because, as Eric pointed out, you need a tremendous amount of money to bring to bring any players to Philadelphia, but especially if you have a 32 draw and you're going to have any real sampling of the top 20, let alone the top 10, the money you need is just massive. And so tennis would benefit, Philadelphia would benefit, the sport would benefit from there being more smaller tournaments and smaller markets. And I think Philadelphia could do that because the amount of money, the number of courts necessary, everything would become handleable in terms of its scale. And that would be my goal. I think the interest is here in tennis. In the tennis community, but it's just a matter of what gets brought into town and the problems for it, site costs, ROI for sponsors.
Yeah, Eric, assuming there was any interest on all of those, you know, multi-headed Hydra entities there, that would want to put another tournament out there, whether it's something what Skip describes. I mean, what is the interest level in Philly? You know, we've talked about some of the weaknesses, which is the facilities. There's no sort of centralized place, whereas in Cincinnati, I think Western and Southern, they built a complex there. They essentially did the same thing in Charleston. These are smaller markets that are willing to sort of get behind a project like this because they may not have a whole heck of a lot to point to. Since Cincinnati's got some, you know, pro sports franchises. Miami, I think, created an entity out there, as did Indian Wells. But what are, we know what the weaknesses are here. What are Philly's strengths, but what's also the interest level, Eric?
Yeah, and I think Skip's correct. That's what I would call the Challenger Tour. It fits easier into any infrastructure for a variety of reasons. The flip side of it, Doug, is that you don't have the big names. You have the emerging players, right? So it'd be like the hardcore tennis fans who would want to watch it. We would love to bring a tennis tournament to Philadelphia. I love tennis. I refuse to play pickleball. I just don't want it to, like, okay, just sort of be on the record, okay? But that pickleball is not our problem. You need partners, Doug. This is a business model, okay? This is not sports memorabilia. It's not history. It's hardcore cash and money. It's a business model. You need partners, okay? When we bid on the FIFA 2026, which became bigger than us, really, we had to outsource it. We needed Lincoln Financial Field. The stadium actually isn't big enough. They have to expand it, okay? They have to be willing to do that to make it fit. It's a sustainable stadium, okay? So you, I think without a tennis-specific venue, I don't think people want to go indoors. I think it's a different kind of a match. You know, World Team Tennis did great at Villanova, and we were a sponsor, and I loved it, but I think it's a hard sell. I think it's an outdoor sport. And without a tennis venue, you don't have a partner, okay? So I would start there. And I was also would just guard to instead of gloom and doom, you know, things change very quickly in sports. Yeah. And, you know, 1 year, we don't think it's possible. And 10 years later, it is possible. Yeah. So maybe we're just in a holding pattern to see even how the sport of tennis evolves. And Philadelphia is doing great in terms of hosting events. You mentioned many of them, the NFL draft, the Army-Navy game. These are all things that we had to bid on and beat other cities to get them to come here. But without a partner, you know, without a tennis-specific venue, and I don't think Wells Fargo would be willing to give us their arena for 2 weeks, not knowing whether it'd be actually packed every day. Yeah. Okay, so I think that's number one.
Eric, you know,
does the panel agree? Yeah,
you're right about things could change. Brian Roberts may wake up tomorrow and decide after watching the French Open, he wants a Philadelphia event that he could televise around the world. So money talks.
Right. Yeah, and Comcast played a huge role in FIFA because they owned the Spanish broadcasting rights for the largest sporting event in the world. So you just need partners, and in the absence of that, you're just basically, you know, you're just doing sports talk radio and trying to figure, you know, you need real business partners, and that's what we try to leverage, and I don't see it right now. I hope I'm not wrong because I love tennis. I remember being in at the Civic Center and running into Steffi Graf. Hey, Steffi, how are you doing? Sabatini was waiting in line to get a hot dog. Okay. I was waiting behind Sabatini. Can I, you know, she could a hot dog with a ketchup. Okay. I'm right behind her. I didn't say anything.
You
to her
noticed.
I was afraid I was going to scare her.
It's great.
We love sports in Philadelphia. This is a sports crazy city, you know, but we just haven't found the right connection, but I wouldn't give up on it. We'll see.
Yeah,
right. It's entirely possible. It's entirely possible that that the WTA wouldn't have been here for so long if Dennis Alter wasn't a tennis fanatic himself personally.
Yeah,
as he owned Advanta. You know, I'm not so sure that whatever else, you know, underlay Advanta at the end, that it wasn't really his personal love of tennis that drove their sponsorship of the tournament for so many years.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
To your point.
Yeah, I wonder if Brian Roberts, is he a tennis fan, Lou? Do you know? Does he play? Oh, did I lose him there? Oh, don't forget to unmute there, Lou. Don't forget to unmute. Yeah, if you could convince, one more time there, Lou. If you can convince Brian Roberts to take up tennis, then maybe we've hit the gold mine there.
Yeah. Doug, can I ask Steve a question? Steve,
yeah, absolutely, very quickly.
Yeah, Steve, do you think I'm right that we need a tennis-specific venue like Indian Wells has? And
yes, I do. Only thing I'd add, Eric, to what you've said, and I totally agree, it's predominantly an outdoor sport. But as we've seen in evidence at these first 5 days of the French Open, which has been rain drowned,
yes,
the show courts must have a roof. And then you have the best of both worlds, so that when you get these terrible weather and heavy rains, and that you don't want to disappoint the fans, you've got it as an option. So it's partially indoors, it's largely outdoors. But I think otherwise, I'm with you every step of the way.
We've got a break here, but maybe one hopeful thing. When I went in for a slight lateral meniscus tear during a match about a year and a half ago, I went down to Bryn Mawr for their radiology, and woman said, "What are you in there for?" And I said, "Oh, I was playing tennis. I have a little lateral meniscus tear." And she goes, "Oh my God, between you and pickleball, we're working overtime." And I kind of went, "Pickleball?" And she goes, "Oh, some of the people who have come in here have been sedentary for decades and they discovered pickleball." So I think maybe the injuries will thin the herd and that will start propping tennis back up in popularity. Hey, maybe there is a hope for pro tennis returning to Philadelphia after all, if we believe Eric, maybe not, but it hasn't smothered the optimism of our panel, who now in the next segment get to show off maybe a few miscellaneous pieces of tennis memorabilia that they may have. And our King of Sports Collectibles, Nick DePaccia Jr., is going to show us a couple of really cool things in their collection and maybe some spot appraisals for our guests when the Museum of Sports Show continues here on Talk 860, Facebook Live, back in 2-2.
Can you imagine Philadelphia without the Broad Street Bullies or its fabled Spectrum Arena? Well, it almost happened until Lou Scheinfeld and Ed Snyder, otherwise known as Flash and Cash, teamed up to rescue the Flyers and got America's Showplace up and running. It was 1967 and the world was in a whole different place. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's heartfelt memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, now available. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by DePaccia Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas DePaccia is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas DePaccia, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
The Virginia Slim Circuit, featuring the finest women tennis players in the world, is entering its eighth season. Chris Evert, ranked number one, will lead the field in a 12-week tour with $1,250,000 in prize money at stake.
And we're back on the Museum of Sports Show here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. I'm Doug Scheimel along with Lou Scheinfeld. Museum of Sports Show brought to you by the DePaccia Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment and have a hell of a logo to boot. Up next, our King of Sports Collectibles, whose family is the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection, valued in excess of quintillions and trillions of dollars, and are proud partner in the Museum of Sports, Nick DePaccia Jr. Nick, say hi to our illustrious panel of tennis experts here today. Steve Flink, author, of course, Skip Schwartzman, guru, Eric Zillmer, sports marketing dude, and Lou Scheinfeld, king of all media.
Well, we got a motley crew here today. It's good to see everybody.
So I had asked everybody, I don't know who of you, it had a couple little pieces, but I wanted Nick to talk very quickly about a sort of a kind of a one-of-a-kind item that you guys have in the collection. You do have tennis stuff there.
Yeah, it's not, we don't have a great volume of tennis stuff, but we have quality. He doesn't emphasize tennis, unfortunately, in the collection. It's more about the team sports. So like tennis, golf, we do have memorabilia representing those sports. However, it's only highlights. So Lou had mentioned off the air about we'll show Bill Tilden's racket first. So that's Bill Tilden's racket. And
what's the story behind that, Nick? How did that come into the collection?
You know what? I don't remember where it came from. I don't remember who, what auction house we got it from.
But it must have come out of somebody's private collection there. And they've got a couple of, I can't read what that says. This frame strung by, and it almost looks like it's somebody's hammered name into the handle or into the shaft there. And that says from William J. Tilden, October 1926.
Wow.
And of course, I'm assuming that's all catgut right there.
And he was the first tennis superstar, really.
Yeah, and it says, may you be a champion. So maybe this was autographed. It says to Johnny on the left-hand side. What is something like that worth these days? Any idea, Nick?
I think that we could probably get, if we wanted to auction it off, we could probably get like $30,000 for it, I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's magnificent. And Steve, when you take a look like that. Yeah, Steve. Yeah, don't part with it. I agree. Steve, when you take a look at something like this, now, of course, you're a member of the class at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. They've got similar artifacts there. You look at the evolution of the sport. What do you think when you look at this racket?
I'm trying to imagine Novak Djokovic or Carlos Alcaraz racket today. It's just astounding. You know, the way even the way wood evolved before we got to graphite and all the rest. But it's just hard to imagine that Tilden could have played the brand of tennis that he did with a racket like that.
Yeah, well, we're so accustomed to pace and topspin. Now, I know I asked some of you guys, Nick. I asked some of these guys, and who has a little something that you wanted to show, maybe for a little spot appraisal from Nick here.
I've got a few that I pulled up. I have a bunch of programs. This is the Lawn Tennis Championship from 1926.
Oh, wow!
This is from the Westside Tennis Club, 1929. This is 228 tennis tips from Rod Laver. I've got the 1921 Davis Cup contest program. Another championship nationals from 1927. I still have programs. I wasn't sure where they were fast enough from the U.S. Pro Indoor. I have a number of them, maybe three or six of those. I have the earlier, what predated YouTube, if you wanted to see how somebody hit their forehand and backhand.
Flip cards. Oh my God. I forgot all about those.
I love it.
Oh my God.
Forehands and backhands for Rod. I have, let's see. I have two more to show you. This is me as a ball kid for Labor and Rosewall at the U.S. Pro Indoor.
That's you at the net post there.
That's me at the net.
Oh my God.
And lastly, I'm going to have to move the camera here a little bit. I have my ball boy t-shirt from the U.S.
Still fit into that?
I wouldn't wear it out this tight. And on the back, I won't show you the back, but on the back, and Lou, you'll probably remember this, it says WCAU, AM 121.
Wow, beautiful.
Really?
They were sponsored the tournament.
Oh, that's
I thought Skip was going to show us one of his tattoos, so I'm glad it was just a t-shirt.
I have some discretion.
So, gotcha. Nick, if you had to pick something out of that group there, potentially the programs or the little flip thing, I had forgotten all about this. My father had those.
Yeah, well, that flip book is something that it would be hard to figure out what it would get because you know, I've never seen anything like that before. So being one of a kind, I can't imagine many of them exist. No. I think that would be, you could probably get a few hundred for that.
Wow.
And I think the programs too, the programs, they're from the 20s. I mean, if they were from like the 70s or 80s, I would say, yeah, but the 20s, I mean, that's vintage. Anything old is always going to appreciate in value, regardless of the sport. Anything from the 20s, the 30s is going to appreciate in value.
All right. Any dollar amount on that one? Skip is looking to fund the kids, great grandkids, college funds.
And I would say like maybe 350, 500, like something around there.
That's better than the kick in the shins. yeah. Anybody else have a little something?
Per program.
I'll go, Doug.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I made a decision early in my career to not collect sports memorabilia. And now I think I made a mistake, but I want to ask Nick, I want to ask Nick in a moment, you know, what the psychology of it is. But I do have a credential from when we hosted the World Team Tennis Finals at Drexel University.
Oh, that's cool.
And I have a memory which is priceless, which is I'm a musician and I put a band together for the tournament, and we played Philadelphia Freedom by Elton John, who dedicated the song Billie Jean King. And she was, of course, there as the owner of the Philadelphia Freedom. Yeah. It stopped her in her tracks. And of course, she's an incredible inspiration to all of us. And so I don't even think like a memorabilia guy. I should have had this signed by her.
But yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
why do people do it? I'm like a downsizing guy. You know, I'm trying to get rid of things.
You're not a hoarder like Skip is.
What's the psychology of it? Why is it worth so much to people, and what value does it have?
Well, Eric, my mom would love to talk to you then, because she's of that mindset: downsize, get rid of the hoarding. But anyway, if you can get it signed by Billie Jean King, that's the move. That would take it from something that's like maybe $100 to something that you could probably get like $300 or $400.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hey, guys, we are out of time. Believe it or not, it's all the time we got for this week. I got to thank our incredible panel of guests, International Tennis Hall of Fame sports writer and author Steve Flink. You're amazing. Philly tennis guru Skip Schwartzman and closet hoarder. Thank you so much. We've got Philadelphia Sports Congress and PHL sports advisor Eric Zillmer, and of course, our king of sports collectibles, Nick DePaccia Jr. And don't forget to buy Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers, created Philadelphia's greatest showplace. Go to themuseumofsports.org, and Lou will pen a personal greeting for you. Museum of Sports show brought to you by the DePaccia Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. For Lou Scheinfeld, Steve Flink, Skip Schwartzman, Eric Zillmer, and Nick DePaccia Jr., I'm Doug Scheinfeld, reminding you of what our good friend Carly Simon always says, Louis.
These are the good old days.
They are. Have a great weekend, guys.